You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security and our sister podcast, Business and National Security Law. I'm Elisa Poteet here in my individual capacity. You know, we've done no fewer than 30 podcasts that discuss the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, or IEPA, as we call it. We've had no real chance to talk much about the use of IEPA as a tool to justify tariffs. And the reason that IEPA has not been used for tariffs until now. So roughly 10 days ago, the Federal Circuit spoke on the topic of IEPA and tariffs, which, by the way, a synonym apparently of which is tax or duty. And it would be an understatement to say that they had a lot to say. In 57 pages, Judges Lori, I may pronounce any of these wrong, I'm just going to say Dyke here, save myself, Reyna, Stoll, Cunningham, and Stark wrote the per curiam opinion, and three of those judges went on to write what they called some additional views on top of that. And then Judge Taranto filed a dissent and was joined by judges, including the CJ, Moore, Prost, and Chen. So that might have been an interesting conversation to sit in on before they sat down and took a pen. But nevertheless, if you're not familiar with IEPA, we encourage you to go back and listen to a more foundational podcast than this one, including any that we may have done with Brian Egan, who is the master of explaining. He answers a lot of questions you might have, like why is Congress giving authority to the president for something already granted him by Article 2 of the Constitution? Or did Article 2 really give the president that authority to use sanctions as trade policy? But tonight, we're going to try to answer some of these questions in a roundabout way by discussing the case of VOS Selections. It's not a household name like Apple, Google, or something else, but it's called VOS Selections versus Trump. And we're going to talk about it with two lawyers very familiar with what happened here, both David Ross and Kelly Dunbar of WilmerHale. David's worked at the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, which we're kind of going to explain. He's also been on the Hill. And Kelly Dunbar has been a guy at the Office of Legal Counsel, which, in case you don't know, is where the big brains live. If you're looking for the smartest people, that's where you can find them. David's worked on some international agreements. And so one reason I thought it might be fun to talk to him is if tariffs have sort of international ramifications. So guys, thank you very much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Our pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Of course. Now let's just assume that people who listen to this don't always know the basics. Let's just start by talking about this court, the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. The first time I heard of it, my response was, the D.C. Circuit? What do those people do? Why don't we talk a little bit about what it is and how this case ended up there?
Sure. So I guess I'll go first. This is David Ross. The Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit is a federal appellate court based in Washington, D.C. It's actually right by the new executive office building by the White House that has nationwide jurisdiction, and it hears appeals from the U.S. Court of International Trade, which is the relevant court here, as well as cases involving patents, trademarks, government contracts, other issues like that. So this particular case involves a series of executive orders that President Trump issued earlier this year that relied on IEPA authorities to impose tariffs on imports. So there were two sets of EOs. One set pertains solely to imports from Canada, Mexico, and China. And the other EO imposed reciprocal tariffs on imports from nearly all countries. So a group of importers filed suit challenging the tariffs in the U.S. Court of International Trade, the CIT, which is a special federal court in New York City with jurisdiction over legal cases arising from laws providing for the imposition of tariffs. The CIT sided with the plaintiffs. The government appealed to the Federal Circuit, thus leading to this case.
So we have a declaration of tariffs in the form of EOs, but we also have this statute that talks about emergencies. Maybe there's a process here, but what's the emergency, David?
So two different emergencies, the Mexico, Canada, and China EOs. I'm going to refer to those as the trafficking tariffs. That's kind of the shorthand that people use. And those EOs are focusing on fentanyl coming into the United States from China, from Mexico, and Canada. and then also some human trafficking allegations and a failure of China, Mexico, and Canada to address this problem satisfactorily. So President Trump made those assertions, declared that a national emergency, and imposed those tariffs in January and February. Then the reciprocal tariffs, which he imposed in April, the emergency in that case was the large and persistent annual U.S. goods trade deficits that have been an issue in our trade for a while, which the EO says have contributed to the atrophy of domestic production capacity, the U.S. manufacturing base, and the defense industrial base. So those were the core bases for the emergency. And then he cited all kinds of examples of how that had manifested.
Interesting use of the word atrophy. So the atrophy is an emergency. If you've gone a week without working out, sometimes you feel that way. But let's move on. Who were the plaintiffs in this case? One jumped out at me, Terry Bicycles. I thought that was interesting. But who were these people? And were they from one discrete industry or economic sector? Because I don't see that these tariffs, and correct me if I'm wrong, and the likelihood of that is about 99%. I don't see anything in here that is economic sector specific. Who were these people?
You're right. It's five companies. They're all small owner-operated companies that rely on imports, but they're all in different sectors. So VOS Selections, the named plaintiff, they're a wine and liquor importer. Another company, Plastic Services and Products, they manufacture plastic pipes and conduits. MicroKits LLC, they manufacture educational electronic kits and musical instruments. Fish USA, sport fishing tackle. And as you said, Terry Precision Cycling, they make women's cycling apparel. And so in all cases, though, they are importing various inputs and components that they use to produce their products. And so the imports then are being assessed in those imports, and or the tariffs, rather, are being imposed on the imports and driving up their costs. So they filed suit.
One thing that I've learned on this podcast was that there was no income tax at the time this country was founded, and that tariffs were quite literally the only way for the government at the time to generate revenue. That was the state of affairs when the Constitution was drafted and responsibilities were divided among the three branches of government. So how did this role of tariffs being essentially an income or importation tax change, and when did it change, and why?
Initially, the income tax came into being temporarily during the Civil War. So that was really the first income tax that the Congress enacted. It didn't last very long. They repealed it in 1872. But there then was some political discussion over the subsequent decades about whether one should be reinstituted. And that finally then materialized in the 16th Amendment in 1913, which established Congress's right to impose a federal income tax, which they then did. And once you had the income tax, then the need to rely on tariffs as a major source of revenue obviously became much less important. And then you started to see over time the level of tariffs come down, which I can talk about in a little bit.
Before you get off that topic, let's talk for a second about, so look, everybody of a certain generation remembers Ben Stein and Ferris Bueller, right? And the discussion of the Smoot-Hawley Tariffs Act. And by the way, the guy's still out there because I see him online. He was a professor at UCLA for a period of time. Do you want to talk a little bit about what that was, when it was enacted and why, and sort of what followed it?
So I already mentioned that Congress enacted the income tax in 1913, so they had a new source of revenue. At the same time, you saw tariffs actually increasing up until 1930, in the Tariff Act of 1930. They reached extremely high levels. That law, also known, of course, as the Smoot-Hawley tariff, it was credited by many as something that contributed to the severity of the Great Depression. And so then coming out of the Depression, sentiment changed for using tariffs and the value of having tariffs. And instead, Congress agreed that it was time to start looking at reducing tariffs. So in 1934, Congress passed the Reciprocal Trade Agreements Act. That was something that was championed by Cordell Hull, who was Roosevelt's Secretary of State. It delegated authority to the executive branch to enter into agreements to modify tariff rates, subject to some limitations, like you can only reduce it or raise it by a certain percentage and things like that. But it did then lead to a whole series of bilateral trade agreements in that period, and then subsequently really leading to everything that happened over the next 50, 60 years. So after World War II, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade and all of the rules that that enacted, including reductions in the tariffs, the WTO agreements that were negotiated in the 90s and entered into effect in 1995. And then, of course, all the modern U.S. free trade agreements over the course of the late 90s and the first decade of the 2000s, which took most U.S. tariffs down to zero. And so for the most part, if you have an FTA, there's no tariffs at all. And the overall U.S. tariff rate was quite low, something like 2% or something like that, until, of course, 2016, and things changed. And we began back in the direction where we are to today.
Let's move on and let's go to which branch of government really could be doing this stuff. And the court had a few things to say about the authority of Congress versus the authority of the executive too. And this is a quote, lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts. I don't even know what that is. Can one of you explain that? And excises, and to regulate commerce with foreign nations, everything but imposts. So I'm curious about that. Kelly, this feels like something within your, let's say, bailiwick. What is this language coming from? And what is the significance of it in the court's opinion?
Yeah, thank you. It's a really good question. The language you're quoting from the per curiam opinion, you know, is actually from Article 1 of the Constitution. And a core part of the debate here in this case relates to this basic separation of powers principle and who is supposed to be exercising the authority to impose tariffs and which branch and under what circumstances. And the argument that the plaintiffs had made that the per curiam opinion really focused on at the outset is that the power to lay duties, just like the power to collect taxes, is a core Article I authority and a critical part of the power of the purse that the Constitution assigned to Congress as opposed to the president. And as we'll see, I think, when we talk a little bit more about the specifics of the opinion, this debate about when and under what circumstances should we assume that Congress is delegated to the executive branch or to the president the power to exercise this critical Article I authority ability to tariff is, you know, I think really at the heart of the debate between the government and the plaintiffs in this IEEPA litigation.
Yeah, and query whether the word, and I've used it, delegate, is really right. Because it is the case that there's been a lot, including IEEPA itself, obviously, a lot of things have been sort of transferred for one reason or another, and then never transferred back, as far as I can tell. So how did the court characterize tariffs? Because I thought this was a pretty central part of the opinion.
The per curiam opinion, you know, looks back to founding era documents, including some concerns raised by Patrick Henry that it was critical that the power of taxation belonged to the legislative branch. Otherwise, the president could become like a king. And James Madison replied, the court notes, that this would not occur because the purse is in the hands of the representatives of the people. The court then goes on to cite our friend Alexander Hamilton in Federalist Number 12, who made the point that I think you were alluding to earlier, that tariffs at the time of the founding were a critical source of revenue. In other words, the connection I think the per curiam majority is trying to draw is that at the founding of the country, the framers understood that the power to tariff was essentially the power to tax. The power to tax was a critical part of the power of the purse that the Constitution deliberately assigned to Congress under Article 1, as opposed to the president under Article 2. I mean, again, that separation of powers debate and that framing of tariffs as a tax really plays a central role in the plaintiff's challenge to the tariffs, as well as the Federal Circuit majority's opinion, which I'm sure we'll talk about a bit more in a bit.
It is interesting that they said, a synonym for tariff is a duty and a tax. And I'm not aware of any sort of shifting etymology in the use of that term. And maybe one of you can correct me, because I know that there are words that over time in the English language, and particularly in American English, come to mean something very different from what they did 200 years ago. But I noticed that there's no reference to an alteration of the meaning of the term tariff. There wasn't a single thing. And then I was looking for that, actually, as I read the opinion. Has Congress ever enacted legislation establishing a basic tariff schedule? And can you say what a basic tariff schedule would even be?
Historically, yes. Back in the early period that we were talking about earlier, Congress actually did enact the entire schedule. And so the Tariff Act of 1930, as I mentioned earlier, Smoot-Hawley, that was actually something like 95 pages of tariff schedules. And so if you look at a schedule, what you see is it's a line of tariff subheadings, so covering all these various products, and then the tariff rate for that product. And over time, it's become more complicated, but that's essentially what it is, a rate for everything that's coming into the United States. And back in those days, that was negotiated by Congress, but it proved to be unwieldy and difficult. And for all the reasons I've already described, plus the difficulty, it over time has been shifted over by delegation to the executive branch. So I've already talked about the move away from tariffs toward the trade agreements program, the bilateral agreements and the GATT and everything else. And what you see now is more that Congress gives the authority to the executive branch to go and negotiate, and pursuant to notification requirements, pre-notification requirements, post-notification requirements, especially in the modern day than up until recently, the executive branch and the committees, Ways and Means and Finance, which are the congressional committees with jurisdiction over trade, they actually will work together to draft the implementing legislation for a given trade agreement. And then Congress will vote on the implementing act and say either yes, we approve it, or no, we don't approve it. And then it becomes law. But so it's more of a partnership, and it's a congressional executive agreement is the way that we do most of our trade agreements these days, at least up until the U.S. stopped negotiating them, about 8 or 9 years ago.
Just out of curiosity, David, what occasioned us stopping that? What sounds like a pretty good process?
It's always been politically sensitive, the negotiation of trade agreements, and then trade promotion authority, which is the modern term of that cooperative framework. It's always been time limited. And so every time it expires, then there's a debate about whether to reenact the authority so that the executive branch can go out and start negotiating new agreements. And just candidly, I mean, the Trump administration didn't support the program. They didn't think it had worked out, like you said. There was concern about trade with China. So they pretty much stopped negotiating the agreements, except for the modifications of the North America Free Trade Agreement, which was renegotiated and then, relabeled the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, the USMCA. But that was pretty much the last one that the U.S. has done. And then President Biden actually shared that view of these comprehensive FTAs and decided that there wasn't going to be any market opening trade agreements done during his term. And now it's continued as well, of course, in the current term.
I mean, it sounds to me like both administrations had an acknowledgement of what was concerning trade imbalance with China. And maybe they both understood that, this thing had metastasized in such a way that something dramatic needed to occur. The question is, I guess, whether this was the answer. But let's talk for a second about sort of some other legislation out there. There is something called the Trading with the Enemy Act, which almost like most national security lawyers have at least heard about at some point. Where did this law come from, and why is it that this was being referenced in this particular opinion on IEEPA and tariffs?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Trading with the Enemy Act was first enacted in 1917 to address various threats to the U.S. economy resulting from the United States' entry into World War I, and gave the president various authorities. It was amended in as relevant here in 1993 and then again in 1941, and it bestows upon the president, originally during wartime, the authority to take various actions. And among the actions that the president is permitted to take in certain circumstances is to, quote, regulate the importation of certain foreign property. We will get into a bit more detail later, and I think will make more sense when we talk a bit more about the Federal Circuit opinion. The TWEA, or Trading with the Enemy Act, and that specific phrase, regulate importation, was transplanted into IEEPA and is really the heart of the statutory debate in this case, whether that phrase, regulate importation, permits the president to regulate importation through tariffs. And there's a really fascinating and interesting historical use of the TWIA authority by President Nixon that really is a key precedent for the government in its argument that IEEPA does include, at least in certain circumstances, the authority to use tariffs.
Well, but let's turn to the plain language of IEEPA, which for our listeners, it's sort of part of a group of statutes that begin at 50 U.S.C. 1701. I think of that as the sanctions statute. What I don't think about, Kelly, is whether or not it really has anything to do with tariffs. But what did the court have to say? Because they really took a deep dive here, more than I've ever seen in another opinion. But you can correct me if I'm wrong about that.
Yeah. So both the majority and the dissent focused on the text and history of the provisions, and really, as the 150 pages or whatever it is suggest, did a robust, I think, analysis. I think in critical respects, there are two parts of the IEEPA statute that are relevant. Section 1701 of IEEPA authorizes the president to declare a national emergency with respect to, quote, unusual and extraordinary threats, unquote, that have their source wholly or substantially outside the United States. Once preconditions in Section 1701 are satisfied, Section 1702 describes the powers that the president may use to, quote unquote, deal with the national emergency that the president has determined under the first provision. And there are various powers that are listed explicitly in the statute, including the power to, quote, investigate, block during the pendency of an investigation, regulate, direct and compel, nullify, void, prevent, or prohibit, unquote, certain forms of foreign property. That's a long list of verbs: investigate, block, regulate, direct, and compel. What's absent and sort of critical to the plaintiff's argument is that that doesn't mention tariffs, while the government's core position is that the phrase regulate importation, both as a matter of plain meaning, but also in historical context, can include the power to use tariffs. And there are a variety of arguments that the government makes in defense of that position. I think a critical distinction for understanding the seven judges who voted in the majority is that those seven judges didn't necessarily agree on why IEEPA doesn't authorize the president's tariffs. By my count, I think there were four judges in the majority who thought the phrase regulate importation simply never includes the power to adopt duties or tariffs, full stop. Three judges in the majority apparently were not prepared to go that far and instead adopted a narrower argument or embraced a narrower argument, which is that even if IEEPA could authorize tariffs sometimes, these tariffs are a bridge too far for specific reasons. I think we can talk a little bit more about in a bit.
So what did give the president the authority to do this, to issue these tariffs? David, one of my questions is, you might want to take a second and as you answer this to just sort of generally talk about what these tariffs were in terms of the sweeping scope of them, because I think it wasn't as broad a feature of the analysis. They were looking more at statutory language and so on. But I think that's a fact that cannot be ignored. It's the white elephant in the room is sort of the sweeping scope of this. But where did the president then get this authority according to these obviously august jurists who could not all agree?
The scope is pretty sweeping. I mean, especially the reciprocal tariffs. The reciprocal tariffs, the second executive order that I mentioned that was addressing the balance of payments issues, they apply to imports from all countries, almost all countries, and a baseline tariff of 10%. And then in addition to that, an additional country-specific tariff on about 57 countries. And that's changed some over the last few months since President Trump initially announced those tariffs. So very broad. There are some carve-outs from the breadth for products that are currently subject to investigation under other trade laws. So there's a law called Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act, which allows for the adjustment of imports to address threats to national security which is something that President Trump has used to put now tariffs in place on steel, aluminum, autos. And then there's about eight other investigations going on right now for a broad range of other products for additional tariffs. Those types of products, those categories of products are carved out of the IEEPA tariffs pending these other determinations. But there aren't many other carve outs from the tariffs. Just a few days ago, President Trump issued a new executive order that creates a process for the potential exclusion of some categories, civil aircraft products that are covered by the WTO Agreement on Trade in Civil Aircraft, unavailable natural resources, in other words, products that aren't available in the United States in sufficient quantities like coffee, and then various types of generic pharmaceutical products and inputs. But those categories, basically what he has said is these can potentially be excluded from the reciprocal tariffs, but only on a country-by-country basis if foreign countries reach a deal with us to address our concerns with our bilateral trade relations with them. And then in that case, we may be willing to eliminate the tariffs on those categories. But it's a pretty small universe. The Mexico and Canada tariffs, he has excluded from the tariffs products that are compliant with the USMCA rules of origin. So products of Canada, products of Mexico are not currently subject to the IEEPA tariffs.
Let's talk a little bit about this whole idea of delegating tariff authority. To me, a delegation suggests that you're sort of giving a subordinate responsibility, but I think that the term here is used somewhat differently. They pointed out that all delegations of tariff authority by Congress to the executive were intended to be cabined in some way. There are some limits. So what were some of these limits that they thought important to reference in denying the government's appeal?
Sure. So here we're not speaking of IEEPA, we're speaking of other laws that provide for the imposition of tariffs. And so some examples, Section 122 of the Trade Act of 1974, that is a provision of law that authorizes the president to impose a temporary import surcharge when necessary to address large and serious U.S. balance of payment deficits. That authority is limited in that the tariff can't be higher than 15%. The surcharge can't be higher than 15%. It can't be kept in effect for longer than 150 days unless extended by act of Congress. So it's time limited and it's also limited in scope. Another example, Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974, that's the law that President Trump used in his first term to put tariffs on China. And that was historically, for the last 30, 40 years, the principal U.S. statute for taking unilateral action against unfair foreign trade practices. But that law is very detailed in terms of the procedures that USTR has to follow. There's an investigation, but it's required to seek input from the public on whether the act that's being looked at is in fact actionable under the law. If USTR decides that it is, then in determining what type of action to take, that again has to be put out for public comment. So USTR will typically publish a list of potential products to be tariffed, and then you get input from the public on that. That has to be taken into account in the final action taken. The action itself has to be reviewed after 4 years or else it's revoked. And so those are some examples for 301. I could talk about more if you like, but you see similar types of process requirements, reporting requirements, and in some cases, cabining in on the scope of the permissible action requirements in five or six different laws that provide for the application of tariffs.
Okay, well, the court made some hay about the distinction between the authorization to regulate and how that is distinct from a power to tax. We've touched on this a little bit, but do you want to talk a little bit more about that or expand on that discussion, Kelly?
Yeah, absolutely. As we talked about before, the core statutory language from IEEPA, which again was borrowed from TWIA to get as many acronyms as possible into that short sentence. The key phrase is regulate importation. And so a critical part of the plaintiff's challenge is that ordinarily that there is a difference between the power to regulate and the power to tax. In support of that argument, the plaintiffs and at least some judges on the Federal Circuit appear to agree that Article 1 of the Constitution itself separates out the power to regulate foreign commerce from the power to impose taxes. The challengers also make a number of examples of the potential breadth of a contrary interpretation. So, for example, they say that the SEC The Securities and Exchange Commission has the power to regulate securities. The FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, has the power to regulate communications services. And the challengers and some on the Federal Circuit say it would be extraordinary to believe that in giving the SEC or the FCC the power to regulate in that context, that Congress had actually delegated to those agencies its core power to tax. So in essence, the plaintiffs are arguing, and again, at least some of the judges on the Federal Circuit seem to agree, that when Congress delegates the power to tax, when Congress delegates the power to tariff, it speaks clearly and unequivocally about that power, and that we shouldn't, and that court shouldn't, take overly capacious, broad readings of regulate to include the power to tax.
Let's talk about for a second, the government in this case argued that the CCPA justified this expansive use of tariffs and the executive orders that were underpinning them. Can you talk for just a second, Kelly, about what is CCPA and how did the court respond?
So the CCPA was the Court of Customs and Patent Appeals. It was the predecessor to the Federal Circuit that you and David talked about at the start of the cast. The reason the CCPA is so critical relates back to TWIA and some tariffs that President Nixon imposed. In 1975, the CCPA held in a decision called United States versus Yoshida International that the Section 5B of TWIA, which included the regulate importation language that we've talked about, authorized President Nixon to impose a 10% import duty surcharge on all durable goods entering the United States as a response to the balance of payment crisis that existed in the country after the collapse of the Bretton Woods system. And the lower court in that case had actually held that TWIA doesn't authorize tariffs, foreshadowing many of the arguments that the challengers are making here in the IEEPA context. But the Court of Customs and Patent Appeals disagreed and said that this was broad language and that read naturally, one way that you could regulate an import is through the imposition of duties. The government statutory argument is that Congress enacted IEEPA after the decision in Yoshida, that Congress was aware of the decision in Yoshida, and that Congress took the exact identical language, regulate importation, and transplanted that in IEEPA, supporting the government's position that, again, at least in some circumstances, IEEPA should be understood to permit the president to impose tariffs.
First of all, I think as a basic matter, I'd ask you to just do two things. Assume we have lawyers who don't look up Latin words like per curiam, and might want to explain whether that means there was some sort of consensus, a majority opinion, unanimity of some sort, or something else. And then separately, the second question that I think we should address, and we should always address whenever looking at sort of a conclusion of any opinion, is what was the standard of review? And for young lawyers, why don't you say why it is you should always note the standard of review, and that should sort of inform your writings or your analysis of anything.
Absolutely right. In reviewing any opinion, it's critical to understand the procedural context and the standard of review. And the standard of review, as the name suggests, is simply the level of scrutiny that a reviewing court gives to the decision that's actually on review. And so I'll violate your don't use Latin again, but explain it this way, that the Federal Circuit's review here was de novo, which essentially means it was a blank slate. The Federal Circuit was deciding these critical issues of law without deference of any type to either the government's position or to the CIT's decision. You know, one interesting thing, though, about the procedural posture standard of review in this context is that this was a decision on summary judgment. And one thing that Judge Toronto at least hinted at in his dissent was that the challengers of the tariffs, in his view, had not attempted to put forth any evidence challenging the president's determination that persistent and accelerating trade deficits were actually an extraordinary threat to the United States that justified unlocking IEEPA's emergency powers. The implication seeming to be that, at least in his view, in an appropriate case, someone might actually be able to attempt to introduce evidence to suggest that the emergency that unlocks the emergency powers in IEEPA actually isn't a bona fide emergency. But I think as this case moves forward to the likely to the Supreme Court, as I'm sure we'll talk about in a bit, the issues for the most part are really just questions of law, which each reviewing court will decide for itself without deference, again, to the government's position or to the lower court positions.
Okay, and non-lawyers listening to this will say, well, what does per curiam mean? Does that mean they all agreed? What is the point of a per curiam? It's a Latin term, and it means what?
Opinion. Yeah, it means opinion of the court. And you know, what's interesting is usually the term is used when there is not sort of an individual author identified, which doesn't really seem to be the case here. I suspect that it was used in part because it's possible different judges wrote different parts of what became the majority opinion. And then, of course, you also had the additional views, by my count, four judges, actually, who were willing to say IEEPA never authorizes tariffs. You had three who apparently weren't willing to go that far, but were willing to say that these tariffs were simply a bridge too far. So you ended up with a coalition of seven coalescing at least on that narrower proposition that these particular tariffs are unlawful. And I suspect that's why the court chose to use the per curiam label in this case. But I do think it's very important as we think about how the Supreme Court potentially will be looking at this, that even among the seven judges willing to invalidate the tariffs, there was not a consensus on why the tariffs were unlawful. And I think it's also notable that the majority in the Federal Circuit really didn't seem to agree with the primary rationale that the Court of International Trade, the three judges at the Court of International Trade, had relied on below. The CIT had essentially held that under separate section of the Trade Act, Section 122, which Congress enacted after the Yoshida decision, that Congress meant to channel any tariffs relating to trade deficits or balance of payments through Section 122. And it was for that reason that IEEPA was not appropriate in this particular case. By my count, no judge on the Federal Circuit seemed to accept that position. So you have lots of, between the lower court and the Federal Circuit and the various opinions, you have agreement that the tariffs are unlawful, but not necessarily a strong level of consensus precisely on why the tariffs are unlawful. And, you know, again, if as this case winds its way up to the Supreme Court, the, you know, Supreme Court will be confronted with thinking about all of those different potential lines of attack and defenses of the tariffs.
If you look at social media and we're all in these information silos, it's always interesting how these things are characterized. There's really very little discussion of the law, or oftentimes there's little acknowledgement of the reasonableness of some of the jurists with whom you may not personally agree. But in this case, there were four judges who dissented, and you've sort of alluded to this and you've made some reference, but let's sort of nail this down. Four judges dissented, and they had a basis, though, and actually bases for their dissent. I think it's important to talk about what they saw, because it could easily be something that the Supreme Court picks up on, sides with, or finds just more appealing in terms of their analysis of what they'll be looking at. So what happened?
Yeah, you couldn't be more right about that. Whether you think the dissent was right or wrong, I think it's impossible to deny that it's a thoughtful, reasonable opinion. And, you know, I think it's notable it was authored by appointee of President Obama, Judge Toronto, and was also one of the a second of the other four was also Judge Chen, an appointee of President Obama as well. The dissent first held that by their lights, the phrase regulate importation authorizes, at least in appropriate circumstances, the use of tariffs. The dissent argued that Congress doesn't need to use magic language to give the president authority, and that naturally one way that you could regulate importation is to use monetary measures such as tariffs to control imports into the United States. Really, a linchpin, I think, of the majority's analysis was that this doesn't result in a broad, unlimited tariff authority that steals a constitutional authority the Constitution assigns to Congress. The dissent laid out that there are all types of limits in IEEPA. The president needs to declare a national emergency. That national emergency expires at the end of a year, subject to renewal by the president. Congress itself can, through concurrent resolution, override the declaration of emergency, and that claims that this is a unbounded, unconstitutional delegation, if you read regulate importation to mean tariffs, were unfounded. Second, the dissent said that there was really no basis for adopting the view that the limits on tariffs that the CCPA had recognized in Yoshida, which were that they were not on all products, that they were largely consistent with the harmonized tariff schedule that Congress set, and that they were temporary, that none of those circumstances in Yoshida were necessary conditions for the president to exercise IEEPA tariff authority. What the dissent really said is that, look, there are basically four limits in IEEPA that the president has to follow. Has to be an unusual and extraordinary threat. The threat has to be wholly or substantially outside the United States. The president must declare a national emergency, which Congress can have a say in overriding. And the particular authorities must be exercised to deal with that threat and for no other purposes. And the dissent said those four conditions are all satisfied in this case. The dissent also argued that there was no constitutional non-delegation problem with that reading. One of the arguments that the challengers had made is that if you read IEEPA to authorize the importation of tariffs, that would raise a concern under the so-called non-delegation doctrine under the Constitution, which in a nutshell is that when Congress delegates to the president one of Congress's Article I responsibilities, it has to have a so-called intelligible principle that can guide the executive branch's exercise of discretion. And Judge Taranto and the other dissenting judges believe that, at least in light of existing Supreme Court precedent, IEEPA plainly satisfied that intelligible principles test. So again, as I think your question alludes to, I think it's a significant development that this was a 7-4 decision, you know, not an 11-0, not a 10-1, really in either direction, and that you had thoughtful jurists really on both sides of this debate.
This is an interesting opinion for some other reasons. And for one of the things that jumped out at me was the history that the majority failed to cite, but the dissent did. They talked a little bit about something called the Special Committee on the Termination of the National Emergency. Why are they talking about this? Why on earth did Frank Church's name come up in their discussion? Everybody thinks of him as the Church Commission guy. Why was that even in there? And what were they saying?
In the 70s, basically, Congress got very concerned with the exercise of the president's emergency authorities. And so IEEPA was enacted against that backdrop, the National Emergencies Act, which IEEPA incorporates, was also enacted during that time frame. And that all results from the 1972 Special Committee on the Termination of the National Emergency. And the dissent really uses that history to say that, look, the exercise of national emergencies and the delegation to the president in times of national emergency of certain emergency powers has been something that Congress has been a mainstay of the country for, you know, at least the last century, that Congress had its eyes wide open to those issues in the 1970s when it enacted IEEPA or when it amended IEEPA, and that Congress did impose constraints on the president, that IEEPA was, in a sense, meant to limit the president's national emergency authority, but that Congress limited that authority The dissent argues through requirements to notify Congress, through the ability of Congress to overrule a national emergency determination, through the expiration of the national emergency after 1 year. But critical to the dissent's analysis is that what Congress did not do is actually impose additional limits once a national emergency is declared on the particular powers that the president can use to respond to that particular national emergency. And again, that circles back to the whole debate over whether did Congress, in enacting IEEPA and borrowing the regulate importation language, effectively ratify the CCPA's decision in Yoshida that IEEPA does include the power to impose tariffs.
Let's leave this for just a minute, because I honestly think that this is an opinion you could mine and discuss for weeks. But the question that everybody has right now is, what's going to happen next? And these are not just people going to Vegas. I mean, people are wondering, what is going to happen next? Now, you guys are in firms, probably reluctant to make prognostications, but what do you think is going to happen here?
Yeah, so just in terms of the timing of things, you know, as our listeners may or may not be aware, on September 3rd, very shortly after the Federal Circuit's decision, the government filed a petition for a writ of certiorari with the Supreme Court for the Supreme Court to hear the case. It, at the same time, filed a motion to expedite consideration of the case, and it noted, and this was subsequently confirmed by a later filing, that the plaintiffs in the case, the tariff challengers, agreed that the Supreme Court, or acquiesced in the view that the Supreme Court should take the case, and also agreed that there should be expedited consideration, and really very expedited consideration. Under the proposal filed by the government, the Supreme Court will decide whether to grant the petition on September 10th, 2 days at least from when we're recording. Briefing under the proposed schedule would be wrapped up by the end of October. And there was a request for oral argument in front of the Supreme Court in the first week of November. One of the arguments the government has been making in favor of expedition is that even though the Federal Circuit's decision is effectively stayed, which means the tariffs are still in effect, despite losses by the government at the CIT and the Federal Circuit, the tariffs are still in effect. But the government has said that the rulings themselves are injuring the United States in its ability, among other things, to negotiate new trade deals with foreign countries in light of the Federal Circuit's holding. So, David, setting aside the sort of specifics of the court timing, I don't know if you have thoughts in terms of what might happen on the tariff front, you know, over the next few months while the Supreme Court likely takes this up.
Yeah, thanks, Kelly. So if you follow the news on the Supreme Court litigation, one thing that you see from, for example, some of the members of the administration and their allies, they say, well, look, we're not going to lose. But if we do, we have plenty of other authorities that we can use to put tariffs in place. And I touched on some of those earlier. You know, one of them in particular, as I was saying before, is Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act. That's, again, the law that President Trump used to put 50% tariffs on steel and aluminum and all kinds of derivative products that include steel and aluminum, 25% tariffs on imports of autos and auto parts, and then ongoing investigations for just an enormous number of different product sectors, semiconductors and products that contain semiconductors, pharmaceuticals and pharmaceutical ingredients, aircraft engines and parts, critical minerals, timber and lumber products. In that case, has a scope that's so broad that even includes things like furniture imports. So President Trump was talking about the possibility of tariffs on furniture imports a week or two ago, and then a few others. And so you're going to see these decisions coming out. There's a lot of questions about how they're going to be announced and implemented. There's some talk about maybe the pharmaceutical tariffs will go into place right away. Maybe there will be some delay. The semiconductor tariffs, there's been some suggestions that maybe if companies agree to invest in the United States, they won't be subject to the tariffs. But that's really a very novel approach to that law that hasn't been used before. So a lot of things to watch in terms of new tariff actions. And then in parallel with that, the negotiations, as you said, Kelly, there's a lot of ongoing negotiations right now with trading partners. The U.S. and the EU announced a framework agreement a couple weeks ago. The U.S. and Japan have announced one. Others ongoing. We're waiting to see what Canada and the U.S. agree. We're waiting to see what the U.S. and Mexico agree. et cetera, you know, across the world to try to find a way to reach some accommodation that will lead to a reduction in these tariffs, both the IEEPA tariffs and the 232s. Lastly, I think something that's interesting is there's a statutory requirement for the United States and Canada and Mexico to revisit the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement next year. And that process is supposed to kick off pretty soon. And it's going to be really interesting to watch that as a kind of predictor of how our trading partners writ large are going to respond to this new world over the longer term, because a lot of these tariffs already imports from Mexico and Canada, some portion of those are subject to these IEEPA tariffs, when under the terms of the USMCA, it's all supposed to be duty free. And so what position will the US take during the USMCA review? Are they going to try to get Mexico and Canada to agree, okay, we'll actually instrumentalize this new status quo somehow in the USMCA? How are we going to change the rules to address our concerns about China? Things like that, all very interesting, really groundbreaking new steps in this strange world we find ourselves relative to what I've been working in for the last 30 years.
I'd like to talk about our foreign governments that we deal with just briefly and say that one of the things that we talk about is our sense of time. And our sense of time is very different from the sense of time of a Vladimir Putin, for example, who's still hung up over the Duchy of Lithuania in, you know, the 14th century. And, you know, maybe sometimes thinks, well, I'll just wait out this president. But I think there's a sense of time issue here that it underlies this discussion of, you know, Congress potentially turning over, a new administration coming in. I mean, how do we ever get over those sort of differences? And how is this any different if it is? Do either of you have thoughts on whether there's anything the administration could do to sort of change the fact that we have a system that balances and alters over time? And, you know, China's run by what is essentially a dictatorship and a hegemony of the CCP. And then Russia, I mean, I imagine Putin's going to die while he's sitting in office. The guy's like black mold. You can't get rid of him. We're stuck with him. He's going to be there forever. And yet we're going to continue to organically and constitutionally turn over. So is this anything new? Is this anything occasioned by this trade policy? Or is this just, it's just the way things are set up in the world?
You know, you mentioned Toledo, and I think that folks in trade could go on for a long time talking about, is it imports? Is it changes in technology? What's responsible for what we've seen happen to the U.S. economy? But I think, honestly, there needs to be some recognition that when the United States agreed to bring China into the WTO in the 1990s, there was an expectation that China would react in a certain way, and that it would lead to some reforms. People used to talk about, you know, the South Korea example, and see how South Korea became a democracy because of trade, and so the same thing would happen with China. But that's obviously not what happened. You had an economic system that was based on different principles from those of most WTO members, and China didn't change. And what we found over time was that the WTO wasn't really able to address a lot of those concerns. The US had its practices, and there was a lot of losses at the WTO. It used to drive us all crazy when I was litigating there, to the point where, you know, ultimately the WTO dispute settlement system has broken down, largely because of a perception on the part of the United States that wasn't working to address these types of issues, and that there wasn't will among the membership to fix it. And at the same time, you've had the negotiating function really paralyzed. You know, the WTO relies on consensus, and it's been virtually impossible to achieve anything meaningful in terms of new agreements since the 1990s. And so you have this institution that was really the United States, the driving force, or a driving force in creating it, has lost faith in it. Itself has kind of lost effectiveness. And so what does happen now? If China's not willing to change, will other trading partners want to come together to create something new among, you know, a coalition of the willing, who might be willing to follow the rules amongst them that might even though not follow MFN and treat countries like China a little bit differently? Will the United States be willing to do something like that? Right now, there's pretty much bipartisan consensus that the old system isn't working. And so I don't think we're going to know for a while what the new U.S. position is going to be. So I found it all very interesting. I'm pretty far along in my career, but I tell my associates, you know, you guys are the ones who are going to have to figure this out. So we'll see what's created out of what we have right in front of us now.
Listen, I'm really glad you guys came in. And I wish we could have a longer conversation on this topic. To me, it's just one of the more interesting things that we face. I think some of these imbalances are existentially on some level threatening to the United States. And maybe this is something felt by generations before as technologies and economies and even foreign boundaries changed over time. But I would recommend to our listeners to go ahead and, you know, see what David and Kelly post online. Keep an eye on the court's opinion and schedule. And let's just see where this thing goes. It's been great to talk to you both. And I wish you both the very best of luck in your work. And I'm sure anybody who hires either one of you is very fortunate to have you.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure and a lot of fun.
Yeah, a real pleasure. I really appreciate it. Happy to come back in 6 months and talk more about it.
And thank you very much for joining us tonight. Our guest has been David Ross and Kelly Dunbar of WilmerHale. And I want to thank you for listening to NSLT. Be sure to hit that subscribe button on your listening app of choice. We also encourage you to share this episode with a friend. And I think it's very important to discuss both the facts and the law and hear one another's views. We do not do that enough right now, but it will make you a better lawyer. And if you listen to these two, it's very apparent that they have this capacity, and it's something you need to cultivate if you're young and just starting out in this discipline. And remember, to our listeners, we live in a country that's actually more diverse in thought than any other. Our ability to work through these differences has been a key feature of our national unity, which is obviously a foundation of our national security. Our writer, producer, and host is me, Elisa Poteet. I'm always here in my individual capacity. My co-producer is Holly McMahon. Our program manager is the ever-lovely Antasia Hawkins-Blakeney, who helped us tonight, and I'm grateful. Our editor and co-producer is Francis Burkham. And we acknowledge the contribution of the amazing and brilliant members of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security, without whom this podcast would not be possible. We'll see you next week.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.